Well, hello everyone. Welcome to my presentation on 10 issues related to antimicrobial drugs that you might get asked about. The general format for this presentation and for each issue will be to present a case vignette, ask a question about it and answer it, and then spend a few minutes elaborating on the details. Hopefully, you will find the explanations and the reinforcement to be a useful review. So let's get going with case vignette number one. This is a 22-year-old woman who presents with acute onset chest pain and painful swallowing. Started about 2 days ago, complaining of sharp retrosternal chest pain worsened by swallowing. She has no history of reflux or GERD, no fever, cough, or shortness of breath. You can see the endoscopy results there. And recently, she began a new antibacterial medication for some sort of skin condition about 5 days ago. That skin condition might have been acne vulgaris, might have been something else. So the impression here is the patient has what is referred to as drug-induced pill esophagitis. So here's the question. Based on the case, which antibacterial do you suspect that she was taking? And there they are. And the answer is doxycycline. Tetracyclines, as you're probably aware, are pretty famous for pill esophagitis, in part because they are acidic when dissolved in solution. This is particularly true of the hyclate formulation of doxycycline versus the monohydrate formulation, and it's one reason why the monohydrate is generally the preferred formulation. I'm not aware of any cases or any convincing cases of pill esophagitis associated with these other four drugs. So here is my brief summary of pill esophagitis for your learning, defined as inflammation or ulceration of the esophageal mucosa. Antibiotics as a class account for about 50% of the cases of pill esophagitis that we see. Symptoms tend to appear hours, although maybe days after drug ingestion. We see sudden onset adynaphagia, retrosternal chest pain, and some difficulty swallowing. There's a list of the usual antimicrobial offenders, not listed in any particular order. And I will say the data supporting these sort of varies in quality from drug to drug, but we're pretty convinced about at least tetracyclines as a class. Risk factors for pill esophagitis are listed: supine position after drug ingestion, not drinking enough water, having a pre-existing motility disorder, being older, or trying to swallow large or multiple medications at the same time. And the management of pill esophagitis is pretty straightforward, the obvious first step being to discontinue the offending agent. There are some supportive strategies that can be followed, such as sucralfate, proton pump inhibitors, or the use of viscous lidocaine. And then patients can be recommended to maintain good hydration and to follow a soft diet, at least in the short run. Pill esophagitis is just a great example of why patient counseling with doxycycline and drugs like it is so important. We don't want patients to take the evening dose of doxycycline with just a little bit of fluid so that they don't have to get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom and then to immediately lay down. So the counseling should be to take the pill with at least 8 ounces of water and then to remain upright for at least 30 to 45 minutes before laying down for the night. And that should mitigate the chances of this happening. Okay, let's move on to our second case vignette. This is a 76-year-old woman who presents with acute infusion, hallucinations, and tremors that just recently began. There's her past medical history, and notice the existence of chronic kidney disease with an estimated creatinine clearance of around 40 milliliters per minute. Her vital signs are listed. Few home meds, metoprolol, hydrochlorothiazide, or a diuretic, amlodipine, rosuvastatin. She was worked up for meningitis, and you can see the head CT was normal and nothing of particular interest in the LP. 4 days ago, and this is the important point, is that she began valacyclovir for shingles at a dose of 1 gram Q8 hours. One thing to notice right away about that is at a creatinine clearance of 40, 1 gram Q8 hours is an excessive dose and would not be the recommended dose for shingles. In a patient with this level of renal function, the recommended dose would be 1 gram Q12. So automatically we can make note of the fact that she probably got more drug than she needed. We should also remind ourselves that valacyclovir is the L-valine ester of acyclovir designed for better absorption. So that really when we talk about an adverse effect related to valacyclovir, what we're really at root talking about is an adverse effect related to acyclovir itself. So which of the following would be considered a risk factor for valacyclovir neurotoxicity? And the answer here is A, renal impairment. I think that's a pretty clear answer. I don't know of any association with hyperlipidemia, hypertension, or an active varicella zoster infection and the development of valacyclovir neurotoxicity. I think what we're seeing here is the effect of renal impairment coupled with an inappropriately high dose of drug leading to toxic acyclovir concentrations. I suppose you could argue that hydrochlorothiazide might be contributing to the extent that it might be contributing to dehydration, but I think really A becomes the clear answer. Here's the summary of valacyclovir neurologic toxicity, starting with its presentation. Early on, we see things such as agitation and hallucinations. Later on, we may see tremor, delirium, even seizures. We should add that the onset of these signs and symptoms is typically within a couple of days of starting therapy. Key risk factors, number one, I think, is renal impairment, or at least high on the list. Age, advanced age would be a risk factor, high doses, and dehydration. And if, in fact, the thiazide diuretic she is being administered is contributing to her dehydration, then she arguably has all four of those risk factors. The interesting thing pathophysiologically is that this disorder has been linked somewhat convincingly to the accumulation of a certain metabolite of acyclovir called CMMG, which stands for 9-carboxymethoxymethylguanine. And I'll give you a brief summary about that in a second. So it's not probably the parent drug that's doing this, but it's a metabolite that's responsible. The recommended management for valacyclovir neurologic toxicity is straightforward: stopping the drug. If the therapy must be continued, then certainly the dosage needs to be appropriate. Patients can be hydrated. And in extreme situations, if the drug has to be, or the metabolite has to be gotten rid of quickly, it would be possible to hemodialyze patients, but that would be in an extreme situation. Let's just take a moment and examine this CMMG metabolite. So I'm just showing you the metabolism of valacyclovir being converted to acyclovir. And just a few points to be made about on this slide is that most acyclovir is excreted unchanged in the urine. You know, we think of this as a renally eliminated drug. We have to adjust its dose in renal insufficiency. However, there is a small percentage of acyclovir which is metabolized, and that would be going from left to right on the slide, metabolized into this metabolite called CMMG. And CMMG, like a lot of metabolites, has a long half-life and it is eliminated in the urine. So it will build up in patients with poor kidney function who are given too high of a dose. And it does seem that elderly persons are at particular risk for having a sensitive reaction to CMMG. So high concentrations of CMMG can lead to this problem. And this is all why it's so important with acyclovir or valacyclovir to get the dose correct. Our third case is a pretty routine presentation of acute otitis media. I think the fourth bullet there is the key one. So here we have a 9-month-old male brought to the clinic due to complaints of fussiness, poor sleep, and decreased appetite. He has been tugging in his right ear. He has a low-grade fever and some ear drainage, no vomiting or diarrhea. Nothing, I think, real surprising on the ear exam. But as I said, the key point, the family reports difficulty administering liquid amoxicillin to him in the past due to its taste. Amoxicillin is sort of known for not having the greatest taste, liquid amoxicillin, and therefore they prefer and ask for a once daily dosing option if one is available. And so what is chosen is ceftonir at the appropriate dose of 14 milligrams per kilogram every 24 hours for 10 days. And that 10-day duration is because of his age. So the question is, What adverse effects specific to ceftonir should the patients be warned about? So let's go through these. A, serum sickness. The oral cephalosporin that is most likely to cause serum sickness is probably cefaclor, which is an old second-generation cephalosporin that some of you may remember, and maybe most of you have never prescribed. I'm not aware of any particular propensity for with ceftonir to cause serum sickness. Brown urine is not associated with ceftonir to me. When I think of brown urine, the drugs that I think of are either metronidazole or nitrofurantoin. Skipping to skin discoloration, when I think of antibiotics associated with skin discoloration, I don't think of ceftonir. I think of minocycline or doxycycline or possibly linezolid or certainly clofazimine. And the non-antibiotic that comes to mind that's sort of well known for its blue-green or bluish-gray, I should say, skin discoloration would be amiodarone. So I don't think ceftonir here. And then finally, nausea isn't an adverse effect specific to ceftonir or any other oral cephalosporin. With oral antibiotics that are associated with nausea, I think more of erythromycin or clindamycin or doxycycline or rifampin or maybe even amoxicillin clavulanate. So all this leads by default to red stools being associated with ceftonir, which is the famous answer associated with this drug. So here are the details. So ceftonir is known to cause red stools. This is the stools have take on a red or reddish orange appearance. Typically occurs in infants and young children. And the important point is that it can be interpreted by parents or someone as bloody diarrhea. The cause is that ceftonir is mixing with iron, either in iron-fortified infant formula or in iron supplements. It is mixing with ceftonir and iron are mixing. This is forming a non-absorbable complex, which is then appearing in the stool and turning it red. It is not due to GI bleeding. Patients typically don't have abdominal pain or other GI symptoms. Usual appearance of ceftonir-associated red stools is somewhere between 1 and 5 days of starting therapy. The drug can be continued. It's safe to do so, or it's just as safe to switch to something else. But parent counseling, I believe, here is important. Parents need to be warned that the potential for this harmless red discoloration in stools may occur. It doesn't mean the drug needs to be stopped, and it will go away when either the drug stops or the iron supplementation stops. And not to spend any time on this, but I just wanted to throw this slide in here just to review where ceftonir fits into the cephalosporin scheme of things. It's highlighted in yellow. As you can see, it's one of three orally active third-generation cephalosporins that are available in the United States. So if this ceftonir thing is an issue for patients, then one of the other oral second-generation cephalosporins could be used instead, probably cefpodoxime versus cefixime. I think I'd prefer cefpodoxime there. Or really probably any of the second-generation oral drugs. I think most people would probably choose cefuroxime. Axetil is an option. Or I suppose people could opt for intramuscular ceftriaxone if oral therapy was just not supported. But that's red stools associated with oral ceftonir. Our fourth vignette is a case of osteomyelitis. It's a 62-year-old man who presents with a couple of week history of worsening pain, swelling, and discharge from an ulcer on his left foot. He's been treated in the past without much improvement. And recently, he's developed fevers and difficulty walking. His past medical history is sort of typical or common for these kinds of cases, type 2 diabetes, hypertension. MRI findings are consistent with osteomyelitis. We see gas in the tissue, abscess formation. The wound cultures are not surprisingly mixed flora, including anaerobes. So the plan here is to perform surgical debridement and then follow up with antibiotics for a prolonged length of time. And the antibiotics chosen, ceftriaxone plus metronidazole, pretty standard combination for this sort of situation. And nothing unusual would be involved with dosing. Ceftriaxone 2 grams a day, probably with maybe 500 milligrams of metronidazole orally every 8 hours. My question is, what adverse effect of metronidazole is of most concern in this patient? Most concern. So we're looking at a 6-week course of metronidazole in a patient with diabetes and osteomyelitis and a diabetes and osteomyelitis. So looking at these adverse effects, there isn't a particular reason to be concerned in this patient about nausea, leukopenia, or metallic taste, in my view. Leukopenia, if it occurs with metronidazole, it tends to be mild and tends to be reversible. Nausea and metallic taste are both common, but they're also manageable. The mechanism, by the way, of the metallic taste associated with metronidazole is not known. It can help to have us for patients to have a supply of hard candies to suck on during treatment, or they can use sugar-free mint gum. The idea here is to increase saliva production and help to wash away that bad taste. The famous disulfiram reaction that has been associated with metronidazole when it is taken in conjunction with alcohol is probably not a real thing. I won't say anything more about it now, but I will probably address it during my live lecture in August if you are listening to that. So what does this all leave? Well, the answer obviously leaves to peripheral neuropathy. So the question, what adverse effect am I most concerned about in a patient about to receive 6 weeks of metronidazole who has pre-existing peripheral neuropathy and diabetes would be peripheral neuropathy. So here's what we know about metronidazole-induced peripheral neuropathy. Presents with a stocking glove pattern. There are the risk factors: prolonged therapy, high total dose, pre-existing neuropathy, maybe from diabetes. The use of other neurotoxic drugs would probably be a good risk factor. A good example there being a vinca alkaloid such as vincristine. Clinical features are listed on the slide. It would be important to rule out other causes of peripheral neuropathy such as B12 deficiency, diabetes, alcoholism, or other neurotoxins, as we've sort of mentioned. The management of metronidazole-induced peripheral neuropathy is to stop the drug. The use of neuropathic pain medications can be considered if necessary. And if gait disturbances are an issue, then PT-OT or OT may be useful. The prognosis of metronidazole-induced peripheral neuropathy is good in the sense that most patients probably will recover, but it's going to be slow. Like other drug-induced neuropathies, it can be very slow to go away and maybe sometimes never does. But if you recognize it early, it should. If it is not recognized early and exposure continues, it may not fully recover. So this leads us to maybe a couple of viable stewardship points about using metronidazole long-term. And that is that patients can be counseled to look out for these things so that, warn us if the patient is experiencing burning or tingling or numbness in hands or feet. Well, that we can be warned and that can help. And then it would not be a bad thing to periodically reassess the need for metronidazole if metronidazole is being prescribed for a multi-week period. I think maybe at one time we did this for C. difficile colitis, but as you all know, metronidazole is not really favored too much for C. diff anymore. But for situations like this, periodic reassessment may not be a bad thing, and those would be useful stewardship points. Let's take a look at our fifth case. This is a patient who is being treated for a forearm infection that has developed purulent drainage over the past few days. So he had a MRSA infection last year. Here he is with a fever, although his other vital signs are within normal limits. A little bit of elevation to his white count. His serum creatinine is 1.3, which gives him an estimated creatinine clearance of around 60 mils per minute. Taking valsartan and cortholidone. So the decision by the caregivers is made to incise and drain the wound and then begin a course of trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, 2 double-strength tablets twice a day, Q12 hours until the patient is without fever for 3 to 5 days. Now, if you look that up, the recommended dose of TMP-SMX in this setting based on the TMP component would be 5 to 10 milligrams per kilogram per day divided every 12 hours. At the dose prescribed for him, two double-strength tablets twice a day. He ends up getting 640 milligrams a day of trimethoprim. That's about 9 milligrams per kilogram per day divided twice a day. So he's getting a reasonable dose. And as you also are probably aware, the dose of TMPSMX is not reduced, is not recommended to be reduced until the creatinine clearance falls below 30. So he is okay there with this dose. On the third day of this therapy, the white count has normalized and all his vital signs are within normal limits. He's afebrile, but what is noticed is his serum creatinine has increased from 1.3 to 1.6. So there's a little bit of a bump there. And that's the important kind of issue with this case. So what would be the most reasonable course of action at this point? Well, first of all, C wouldn't be correct because he's only had a couple of days of therapy. I would not favor D because of all the hassle of intravenous therapy and vancomycin monitoring. It would certainly work, but the patient certainly would not be excited about a switch to this kind of therapy either. E isn't right because the purulent drainage we're seeing suggests MRSA. Plus, he has a history of MRSA infection, so we really couldn't use dicloxacillin. So it really comes down to option A or option B. And the best case to be made would be to continue TMPSMX at the same dose. His creatinine clearance is at the same, it's still above the cut point of 30 mils per minute that we mentioned earlier. But what do we make of this bump in serum creatinine from 1.3 to 1.6, and is it likely to get worse? And it is not likely to get worse. So what we're seeing here is this phenomenon of a bump in creatinine caused by TMPSMX without an effect on glomerular filtration. And we normally tie in changes in renal function or creatinine to changes in filtration. But in this case, it's a situation where the creatinine goes up, but filtration doesn't change. So it doesn't really mean anything in terms of clearance of other drugs. The mechanism here is thought to be competition with creatinine by trimethoprim for secretion in the proximal tubule. It's not the only drug that can do this. Bictegravir is known to do this. Cobicistat is known to do this. The typical increase we see in this situation is around 20%. It's probably dose dependent. So maybe a little less if we were giving a double strength tablet twice a day, maybe a little bit more if we were giving a pneumocystis level dose. As I mentioned, no, we don't expect it to get worse. The creatinine bumps a little bit and then sort of stays there more or less around the point it bumps to. The issue, though, can be confusing because TMPSMX does actually cause renal impairment and/or AKI through other mechanisms, and you wouldn't want to sort of confuse any of those things. I mean, so we do know that TMPSMX is associated with acute interstitial nephritis. We do know that crystal urea can be an issue if patients are not keeping themselves well hydrated when they take the drug. And once in a while, somebody will report a case of acute tubular necrosis with TMPSMX, but it's rare. So the point here is if you see an increase in serum creatinine after prescribing TMPSMX, don't automatically assume AKI. It probably isn't. Could be this. It would be useful to assess other clues about renal function before making a conclusion, such as looking at the blood urea nitrogen or looking at urine output. Another pearl worth mentioning here, and I'll just mention it, is to remember that TMPSMX is also associated with hyperkalemia. And that, again, is the fault of the trimethoprim component. What's happening here is that trimethoprim is acting like amiloride, which is a potassium-sparing diuretic. And what amiloride does when you use it as a diuretic is it blocks sodium channels in the collecting duct of the kidneys. And therefore, by blocking those channels, with amiloride, you see sodium loss and potassium retention. Same thing is going on here. So hyperkalemia can be an issue. It is a dose-related phenomenon, and we tend to see it more at the higher doses that you use TMPSMX for when treating pneumocystis pneumonia. And then before we leave the subject, this is just a real brief graphic in case it helps you to remember this, the mechanism. And in the center of that slide is a proximal tubular cell. You can see the blood side and the urine side. And the things I want you to notice are there are up to six transporters in the kidney that transport creatinine from blood to urine in the process of secretion. They're all in blue. And TMP inhibits up to four of them. So that's how TMP is thought to compete with creatinine for tubular secretion, leading to this slight increase in serum creatinine concentrations. Here's a case of cholestatic jaundice. It's a patient who presented with symptoms of jaundice for 2 weeks. No fever, no headache, mouthalgias, etc. No recent or distant exposure to alcohol or illicit drugs, doesn't smoke. Imaging isn't really helpful. His labs show what we thought: hyperbilirubinemia, increased alkaline phosphatase, and a little bit of enzyme elevations in AST and ALT. Important point, though, is that 2 days ago he finished a 14-day course of some antibiotic for respiratory infection. So he didn't have these jaundice symptoms before he started, and now he does. So which of the following oral antibiotics that he might have taken is most associated with drug-induced liver disease? Well, we don't really associate moxifloxacin, ceftriaxone-maxitil, or doxycycline with drug-induced liver disease. So I think we can rule those out. Azithromycin is a possibility, but it wouldn't be used for 14 days. And besides, it's not as commonly associated with drug-induced liver disease as the actual answer, which turns out to be, as you probably already guessed, amoxicillin clavulanic acid, amoxicillin clavulanate for short. Drug-induced liver disease is probably not something that always comes to mind instantly when we think of this drug. I mean, more commonly we probably think of diarrhea or rash. Turns out that amoxicillin clavulanate, and this is Augmentin, is one of the most common causes of drug-induced liver disease. It is much more common than with amoxicillin alone. Risk factors are listed there. Some people would also consider duration of treatment to be an additional risk factor. It's a fairly slow onset. I mean, he was somewhat quick. I mean, I think if you review the literature on this topic, the average onset is about 3 weeks. And patients present with fatigue, fever, nausea, pain, jaundice. The mechanism of this is probably some sort of immunoallergic mechanism. The most common pattern of liver enzyme elevations is cholestatic. So we tend to see increased alkaline phosphatase, increased total and direct bilirubin. You might see a mixed pattern or a more hepatocellular pattern in younger persons. Amoxicillin clavulanate-induced liver disease is usually fully reversible, but it can be slow. And in some patients, full resolution clinically and biochemically might take up to 6 months. Tendon toxicity with fluoroquinolones is pretty famous, so I thought we should say a few things about them. Here's a case of them. It's a renal transplant recipient getting steroids, which is, of course, a big red flag. He's an active guy with somewhat reduced renal function who was given a 14-day course of levofloxacin for prostatitis. At a creatinine clearance of 45 mils per minute, the dose of levofloxacin chosen is too high. The recommendation for a creatinine clearance like that is every other day levofloxacin. So he was given too much drug. After 10 days, he starts complaining of bilateral pain in his Achilles tendons. Although he says it started only 3 or 4 days after levofloxacin began, he was switched to TMPSMX to finish up. Even after the switch, his Achilles tendon was still painful. So his dose was increased of prednisone, apparently to help with the pain. Now, this was the case I was asked to consult on. So I did just a whole bunch of chart review with this case, and it was never really fully clear, at least in the chart notes, why that prednisone was increased. From the charting notes, it appeared to be as a way to help with the tendon pain or a possible way to help the tendon pain. It's the best conclusion I could draw. This case took place before there was really, I think, the awareness of fluoroquinolone-induced musculoskeletal toxicity that we have today. Anyway, he finishes his levofloxacin course, and then a month after all that, he loses his footing, he slips, and he ruptures his left AT. Here's a good thing to know. would be which quinolone is believed to be most associated with Achilles tendon rupture. Now, I threw gemifloxacin on there, although gemifloxacin isn't available in the US anymore. But there's ciprofloxacin, levofloxacin, moxifloxacin, and then the anti-MRSA fluoroquinolone deflofloxacin. The answer seems to be levofloxacin. And the reason I put it that way is that is a, you just have to read a lot of literature and over time to kind of deduce this. Where we stand right now, based on published literature, it does seem to be levofloxacin being the most common offender. I think we used to say ciprofloxacin, a number of years ago, but a lot of that was probably due to the fact that ciprofloxacin had a head start on levofloxacin in terms of case reporting, because ciprofloxacin was approved in 1987 and levofloxacin wasn't approved until 1996. So there's almost 10 years of extra ciprofloxacin use. So it is certainly a class property, but if you were pinned down by someone as to what's the most common cause, my answer would be levofloxacin. But there's still a lot of case reports with ciprofloxacin as well. So this is either inflammation or rupture of tendons that we're talking about, particularly the AT. The incidence of tendinopathy is about 0.14 to 0.4%. The actual rupture event is actually fairly rare. There's only about one or two cases per 10,000 patients. Rupture generally is preceded by tendonitis, but not always. The onset of tendon toxicity with fluoroquinolones is something that happens within days, sometimes weeks, can be delayed by even months, as in this case. Symptoms include tenderness, swelling, stiffness, sharp pain with walking often happens. The appearance of these symptoms tends to be acute. The mechanism of fluoroquinolone toxicity to the tendons is not crystal clear. There are beliefs. They may cause direct tissue injury. They may also induce toxicity indirectly by stimulating local release of tissue-damaging substances, such as nitric oxide. They may stimulate enzymes that damage collagen. There are also known chelators of cations, such as magnesium, and part of this may be that they deplete tendons of divalent cations like magnesium that are essential for maintenance of healthy tendons. I mean, there's a lot of unknowns there and suppositions there. So, I mean, I think the bottom line is we know this to be a phenomenon particularly in older persons. Why exactly it happens, we don't know, I think, for sure. I do want to show you some risk factors. And before I show you that slide, I want to point out, though, that statins do not seem to increase the risk, even though statins themselves may have the ability to damage tendons. So we're going to only focus on the first column here. QTc prolongation is going to come up in the live talk. I spent some time with this chart listing only the risk factors that I could convince myself of. And there they are: age. I bolded steroid use concomitantly because I think that's a clear one. Is persons on steroids who are given fluoroquinolones are at risk. These others, male gender, obesity, increased cumulative days, I think are arguably true. There are other factors sometimes, though, that people identify, such as rheumatologic disease or diabetes, but those are also risk factors for tendon rupture in general. So it's a little bit hard to separate from the fluoroquinolone. And by the way, with some of these other quinolone ones, such as gender and obesity, there is some conflict in literature. So I think I believe the five listed there, but let's just say the first two are the most compelling ones, and there's a little bit of squishiness with the other three. And this topic is so important that I thought a slide devoted only to its management is deserving. And there's the recommendation from the FDA. That if patients have tendon pain or swelling, they should stop the drug and contact their prescriber for evaluation and maybe transition to some non-fluoroquinolone drug. There are some non-surgical management strategies there. And then most patients will recover, but it can be slow. And for some, maybe less than 10%, swelling, pain, and difficulty walking may become a long-term, even a lifelong complication associated with this. Okay, just a few more case vignettes to go. Here's a pretty predictable toxicity. It's a guy with osteomyelitis of his right foot who underwent surgery 3 weeks ago. He has some renal impairment. The creatinine clearance is about 55. He was placed on linezolid at the usual dose of 600 milligrams twice a day. That was started at the time of surgery. He also takes metformin, lisinopril, and aspirin. So after three weeks of linezolid, there's his hematology. He has anemia with a hemoglobin of 9.1, hematocrit 27. He has leukopenia with a white count of 2,100 per microliter, and he has thrombocytopenia with a platelet count of 62,000 per microliter. So he has anemia, leukopenia, thrombocytopenia 3 weeks after starting linezolid, and that's a pretty classic presentation. So in this guy, which of the following is the most important risk factor for myelosuppression? Obesity, the use of ACE inhibitors, and diabetes, as far as I know, are not known risk factors for linezolid myelosuppression, although they may be indirectly linked. I think it really comes down to renal impairment or treatment duration greater than 2 weeks. And I think based on all the published literature and experience with linezolid, I think the clear winner here is the fact that he has been taking the drug for 3 weeks. Renal impairment is second, and I think we don't want to disregard it. You know, linezolid is not a drug which is extensively cleared by the kidneys, but it does have metabolites, and those metabolites can accumulate in renal dysfunction, and those metabolites can contribute to this. On the other hand, in this particular patient, he is obese, and what we know about obesity dosing in linezolid is that 600 Q12 may not be enough. So he may potentially be undertreated, and so in his case, the impact of renal impairment would be further blunted by the fact he's getting maybe less than he should get. But here are the key details. This is a reversible pancytopenia. You know, we don't see blasts or dysplasia on a smear or a marrow biopsy. There are the risk factors. I do believe treatment duration greater than 14 days is the most important. It's also important to note if the patient's on any other marrow suppressing agents. The recommended monitoring for someone getting a prolonged course of linezolid would be to do a weekly CBC with differential. I think that's good advice. If this occurs, this myelosuppression, then the recommendations are to stop the drug, switch to something else, monitor the counts. You should see recovery within a week or two, and if you don't, then it might be useful to contact heme, maybe for a consult. But before we leave this vignette, I just would make this final point. You know, a drug toxicity as potentially serious as pancytopenia can absolutely kill the attractiveness of a drug like it did chloramphenicol, at least in the United States. But there's a big difference between chloramphenicol and the linezolid, and that is this predictability and reversible nature. Myelosuppression with linezolid is both predictable and reversible, and we can work with that. We can monitor for it. We can stop the drug. But neither of those things are true for chloramphenicol. With chloramphenicol, the marrow suppression is unpredictable, it's idiosyncratic, and it tends to be irreversible. And those factors are enough to really bury the agent. So if you're going to commit somebody to more than 2 weeks of linezolid, weekly monitoring and vigilance for this adverse effect would be prudent. Now here's a case, we have two more vignettes. Here's a case of enterococcal endocarditis. A 63-year-old man with diabetes, allergic to ceftriaxone, growing Enterococcus faecalis from his blood, with a creatinine clearance of around 62 mL per minute. Nothing unusual about the susceptibility pattern of his enterococcus isolate. Has a mitral valve vegetation on his mitral valve seen on echocardiogram. So the old school treatment proposed would be amp and gent. I say that because if he did not have ceftriaxone urticaria, it would be a much more attractive choice in him to use ceftriaxone plus ampicillin, given his age and his pre-existing renal insufficiency. But we really see it not as easy to do that, and so someone wants to choose amp and gent both dosed in the appropriate way for 6 to 8 weeks. Which of the following is the most important management concern in him? Well, the first one's not correct. the inability to give amp and gent to an outpatient, but you can do it. I mean, I think the goal would have been here in him would be to transition eventually to continuous infusion ampicillin as an outpatient with once daily gentamicin. So you could certainly do that. C isn't correct because the gentamicin drug targets for this infection are well defined. And E wouldn't be correct because there's generally not a problem using ampicillin in somebody with a, now that's, I made a mistake there. That shouldn't say cefalexin, that should say ceftriaxone. That should say ceftriaxone allergy. There is not a problem with doing that because those drugs do not share the same R1 side chain. So the answer here really comes down to either B or D. And I would argue that while both B and D, nephrotoxicity and ototoxicity, are important concerns, I would argue that in him and probably most patients like him, ototoxicity is the bigger concern. And I can, in the next slide, I can show you why. This slide is to demonstrate why we can work, we can live with ototoxicity, we can live with nephrotoxicity, at least deal with it, and why your ototoxicity can be so much more of a problem. So ototoxicity is similar to nephrotoxicity in terms of what's how it occurs. Nephrotoxicity is a reflection of the accumulation of toxic concentrations of drug in the renal cortex. And probably the same thing is going on in the middle ear with ototoxicity. We can see both auditory and vestibular damage with gentamicin. With auditory toxicity, the high frequencies are damaged first, which is why high tone audiometry is important. And with vestibular toxicity, gentamicin, the impact of vestibular can be devastating on somebody's quality of life. Here are the five bad things of ototoxicity in the slide. Tends to be irreversible. We're not exactly sure who's at risk, although I think the asterisk there at the bottom probably applies. There isn't a well-defined time course with ototoxicity as there is with nephrotoxicity. Generally with nephrotoxicity, you expect it within a week. 7 days is sort of the 5 to 7 days is kind of the magic number for when we tend to see it with gentamicin. Here, it's much more variable. It's not as easy to follow. Ototoxicity is compared to nephrotoxicity. And then finally, you can't feel as comfortable and safe with therapeutic concentrations and lessening ototoxicity. You can't feel as safe with ototoxicity as you do with the kidney. There's actually a poor correlation between serum drug concentrations and the risk of ototoxicity. So for all these reasons, I think ototoxicity is the worst of the two. A rational strategy then going forward in using gentamicin in patients is to perform a risk factor assessment in someone being considered for gentamicin. If a patient is a significant risk for ototoxicity, then a prospective monitoring plan can be devised, which should include serial assessment of auditory and vestibular function. In high-risk situations, it could be helpful to involve otolaryngology, maybe expert consultation, and then in some circumstances, simply it is simply too risky to use an aminoglycoside. This is our last vignette. This is a case of a patient who's admitted to the, who comes to the ED because of a seizure and lost consciousness. He's worked up for meningitis, given the standard three drugs plus dexamethasone. Empirically, he is ruled out for meningitis, turns out to be have a more convincing presentation for pneumonia. So the ceftriaxone that he was given for meningitis at a dose of 2 grams Q12 is continued and not decreased, by the way. The ampicillin and vancomycin are stopped. The dexamethasone is stopped. The azithromycin is an azithromycin at 500 milligrams a day has begun. And then on day 7, he has a jaundice appearance with an increased bilirubin of 5.8. He came in at 2.1. His direct acting fraction is 3.4. He came in at 0.7. He's got some mild right upper quadrant pain. An ultrasound of his right upper quadrant shows biliary sludge and cholelithiasis. No evidence of cholecystitis. So, which drug is the most likely explanation for these observations? In other words, which of these drugs is a known cause of biliary sludging and hyperbilirubinemia, particularly if you give too high of a dose? And I think the pretty clear answer there is ceftriaxone. So it's the phenomenon of the drug being excreted in high concentrations in the bile. We know that ceftriaxone binds to calcium. And the combination of ceftriaxone and calcium in the bile can, the complex that's formed there can precipitate out and form biliary sludge, which typically happens around 90 days of treatment. The pearl here is that ceftriaxone achieves, I believe, the highest biliary concentration of any cephalosporin, literally reaching thousands of micrograms per mil. Risk factors for this phenomenon include high doses given for too long a time, dehydration, receipt of parenteral nutrition, which might reflect calcium administration, and then hypercalcemia. I think there are more cases of, in children, and there may be genetic factors associated with this as well. If you look at the LFTs, they're typically cholestatic in nature. Stopping the drug solves the problem, and the resolution of sludging should be completed in about 2 weeks. It is important to think about this situation because it would be easy to suspect C. diff instead of this. And here is what those stones might look like. These are from a patient who underwent cholecystectomy, and there they are, shown by the black arrows. So with that, I conclude my presentation, and I thank you very much for listening to what I had to say.